Good morning and welcome to Shatteringness. I am your host, Yada. Each weekday morning here on the Genesis Communication Network, I strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission here is to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines. During our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His one and only covenant, and through His always dependable Torah teaching. So with His guidance, you will be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship with Him. Our number, if you'd like to question or affirm anything that I or our guest has to say during today's program over the next 2 hours, is 877-300-7645. I had shared this with you on our Friday program, but I'm delighted to have Kenneth Roberts with us this morning. I was introduced to the writings of Kenneth Roberts by a very good friend of this program, IQ Al-Rasuli, who joins us, as you know, every Friday during the second hour. He had forwarded me a article that begins with these words. It's Muhammad's Greatest Discovery, Kenneth Roberts, Associate Writer. What causes a Muslim woman to honor kill children she has born and raised? The explanation is the Stockholm Syndrome. It is one of the key, or the secret keys, of political Islam and Muhammad's greatest discovery. Now, there is a couple of issues that I have with that opening statement that I'm going to address, and then I'm going to have Kenneth Roberts explain his position, which I personally think was brilliantly researched and is resolutely rational. And we see so little written today that is well-researched, and this is extremely well-researched, and that is the product of logic that, quite honestly, I am extraordinarily impressed with this man's writings. Now, the issue that I have with the opening statement, and I'll state it, and then I'm going to have Kenneth explain his position, is that the there is a bigger issue for the world than a Muslim woman honor killing the children that she has born and raised, although that is an extraordinarily common practice in Islam. In fact, places where records are kept, like the United Kingdom, there are many hundreds of cases over the last 10 years of Muslim families murdering their own children. I'm far more concerned about Muslim parents, Muslim women in particular, encouraging and then speaking glowingly of their children who decide to become suicide bombers because of the carnage they perpetrate on innocent victims. The second is that the article appears on a website that I am also quite impressed with. The website took a unique angle on Islam, calling it political Islam. My guess is it's done that way to garner a larger audience. But as is the case with most religions, Islam is equal part religion and politics. The two are inseparable. There isn't a separate thought process in Islam that is political and another that is religious. They are one and the same. But as for the Stockholm Syndrome being Muhammad's greatest discovery, Kenneth Roberts makes an extraordinarily good argument. Hello, Kenneth. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Tell me just a bit. I understand that Kenneth is Roberts is a pen name, as is the case with 99% of those who expose and condemn Islam, because Muslims have a tendency not to respond with their words, but with deadly weapons. But what was it that initially caused you, Kenneth, to question the motivations of Muslims?
Well, like a lot of people, it began with 9/11. I spent the entire morning of 9/11 watching the television screen with my mouth hanging open in disbelief. as the United States went into Afghanistan to pursue the Taliban and Al Qaeda, I was amazed at the determination of these people to continue their resistance. They didn't just vanish; they kept going. And as different counterattacks occurred throughout the world, I became determined to find out the root causes of this determination.
And in other words,
yes, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so your issue was twofold. It sounds like you and I went about a similar journey, because mine also started on the morning of 9/11, profoundly changed my life, because what I learned, not only about the Islamic religion, but my own religion at the time, was extraordinarily eye-opening. You wanted to know two things. What motivates someone to think that flying airplanes into buildings killing 3,000 people is a moral good? Why would they view this as a moral and appropriate thing to do that pleases their God? So the motivation for that, of course, is the curiosity that so many of us had. And then it sounds like you also had a thirst to know, was it true that these Muslims had corrupted their religion, or was it actually true that their religion had corrupted them?
Well, there's a little of all of that. Muslims are not of one mind on any topic. But here's the thing about Islam. The Islam itself, there's only one authority on Islam, and that's Muhammad.
Correct.
Everyone else has an opinion.
Correct.
When people sit down and study the words and the actions of Muhammad, they come to the conclusion that terrorism is normative Islam.
Correct.
And then they begin to act out that their belief.
Correct.
Either by giving money to jihad or by participating in jihad.
Correct.
Jihad is the, Muhammad called jihad the hump of the camel, which means it's the highest deed in
Correct.
Islam. There is no greater deed than jihad, which is killing infidels. Now, Muslims will say they disagree with that, but that's because they haven't done the research into the original documents of Islam.
I'm going to be a bit play devil's advocate, if I might, here on that. I think that there is some truth to what you just said, that there are Muslims who will claim that jihad is not killing in Allah's cause, and that some of those Muslims who will make the claim have done so because they haven't actually read the Quran and they haven't read the Hadith, which are the oral reports from Muhammad and his companions. Because it is true that if you read the Quran and if you read the Hadith, then there is only one conclusion that can be formed, and that is that Muhammad was a ruthless terrorist. He declared war on the world, and that jihad is fighting in Allah's cause with all arms at one's disposal. That is the only conclusion that can be drawn rationally from the evidence, and it is undeniable. And it is true that that a Muslim who is not a cleric, not educated in the religion, is simply a Muslim by birth, or is a Muslim because somebody approached them and they said, boy, this is really swell, might answer that way for that reason. But any time a Muslim is on television or speaking to the media and is speaking as an imam or as an authority on Islam, they don't have that excuse. They're lying. They know they're lying, and they think that lying, just like killing, is good.
Yes, I totally agree. There are various levels of Islam, Islamic faith. The lowest level is someone who was born into it and who doesn't practice life at all, but has an identification with this culture. Then there are those who are what I call intense Muslims. And the more intense they are, the more likely they are to engage in jihad.
The more intense they are, the more fundamentalist they're going to be, because if they're intense, they're going to study the words and deeds of Muhammad, and they will try to emulate them. If you emulate the words and deeds of Muhammad, you're going to be a terrorist. I mean, there is no way to be an intense Muslim and to study the Quran and Hadith and not be a terrorist. All good Muslims, all intense Muslims, if we are going to use your term, are terrorists.
Well, they will have to come to that conclusion eventually, and at that point they have to either dissociate, which means to go into denial of reality, or else they will just quietly drop out of Islam and they will stop practicing the religion when they become disgusted with the actual doctrine of it. And I think there are about 35% of Muslims are in that category where they've seen enough to turn them off. But they don't want to leave their families. They don't want to leave their culture. They don't want to leave everything. Move to another country and change their name, because that's their only choice.
Islam is pretty clear about what a good Muslim is supposed to do when a Muslim, even a family member, leaves the religion. If a Muslim declares that they no longer want to be a Muslim, then Muslims are ordered to kill them so that Allah can torture them in the hottest places of hell.
Well, this is absolutely correct, and that is the true authentic doctrine of Islam. Most people are just only vaguely aware of it, and if they are aware of it, they just push it out of their consciousness and go back to work, do their job, watch the football game, or so forth. They try not to get too intense about it, because everything in Islam is dangerous, is personally dangerous. Because if you disagree with Muhammad, you become a heretic who has to be killed.
Yep, we're with Kenneth Roberts.
Killers for the family.
And Kenneth, we're at a commercial break here. We'll pick up the discussion with Kenneth Roberts after the break. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We're here with an exceptional individual, Kenneth Roberts, who has written a two-part article called Muhammad's Greatest Discovery. Now that we have identified the fact that there is but one authority on Islam, that anybody's statements regarding Islam, if they do not comply completely with Muhammad's presentation of the religion, are unfounded opinions. So if you want to know what Islam is, what Islam says, what Islam is about, there's only one individual in all of human history that is an unquestioned authority. That would be Muhammad, and therefore you have to read Muhammad's Quran and the Hadith, which are all reports regarding Muhammad. If you want to save a lot of time, since it's free, you can go to prophetofdoom.net and read it, because the entire book is based upon the Quran and Hadith and what they have to say about Muhammad's words and deeds. Now, that said, Kenneth came up with a very interesting proposition that Muhammad's greatest invention, if you will, his greatest discovery, was not the Quran, but was instead the Stockholm Syndrome. And the reason that I found this so interesting, Kenneth, is that I have received tens of thousands of letters from Muslims, a very significant percentage of them women, who have attacked Prophet of Doom. Now, they can't find a single error in Prophet of Doom. Not one of the 10,000 letters has found a mistake in the book. They just don't like the fact that I am judgmental and say that Since Muhammad was a rapist, since he was a pedophile, since he was a mass murderer, since he was a terrorist, since he was a slave trader, he wasn't a very good guy. They don't like that being said of their prophet. But it is interesting that women are the most belligerent. That women who are forced to wear tents around the hijab, women who have no rights in Islam, women who are abused in the religion, become the religion's most ardent supporters. And so the motivation for them doing so was always an odd issue where you couldn't put, why are these people who are treated so badly, the biggest supporter of the very thing that oppresses them and their daughters? And you have written an article on the answer. First, if you wouldn't mind, let's explain for our listeners precisely what the Stockholm Syndrome is. I think most people are familiar with it, but if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about the capture bondage, merciless individuals stopping their torture long enough and intermittently so that the cessation of torture is and abuse is actually considered mercy, and how that creates bonding. Could you share with us a little bit about the very nature of this syndrome that you're associating with Islam?
Well, it's done by a sociopathic people, usually men, who are ruthless and without a conscience. Mohammed fits into this category. He was capable of doing anything that was in his own interest and justifying it as the will of Allah. The Stockholm Syndrome was first seen during a bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, in 1973. The hostages were threatened with murder by the captors, and as a result of this, they went to jail. Two of the women who were captured actually became engaged to the two of the men as they were in jail. After a few days of being captives, they began to identify and perceive the police who were trying to save them as the enemy. Their entire view of reality was completely skewed, and that's due to the confusion which takes place in the person's mind through this bait and switch, Jekyll and Hyde kind of behavior in the captor. They behave beneficently to their captives. They give them food. They give them. They allow them toilet breaks. They talk nicely occasionally, and then they grab them by the hair. They pull them around. They beat them, and the confusion in the mind creates the Stockholm Syndrome. And the person, Mohammed preached religion for 13 years and made 115 converts. But after he discovered,
we're at another commercial break. We'll be right back with Kenneth Roberts and his. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're here with Kenneth Roberts, who has written a brilliant piece on the role of the Stockholm Syndrome in establishing the religion of Islam. He speaks of the disassociation that is associated with a psychological phenomenon known as the Stockholm Syndrome. And before he begins to explain exactly how this became manifest in Islam, it strikes me, Kenneth, that Muhammad was the absolute perfect candidate to perpetrate such disassociation. He was a ruthless terrorist, a money grubber. He was a slave trader. He was amongst the most vile people who ever lived. He was a psychopath. No conscience whatsoever, engaged in rape, pedophilia, mass murder, you name it. If it's awful, Muhammad's the poster child for it. But on the other side, he claimed that he was God's spokesperson, that he was revealing God's message to the world, and it's almost impossible, even today, for someone to make a connection between ruthless terrorist and pedophile and God's witness. Until you recognize that Allah was Muhammad, that Muhammad's God was himself. And then then there is no disassociation, but so few people in the world can have read enough or rational enough to come to that conclusion. So please, Kenneth, tell us the story of how Muhammad stumbled upon the concept of the Stockholm Syndrome centuries before it was published here in the West.
Well, it happened by accident. One of his followers, whose name is Omar, disagreed with women having too much independence. And he found that as Mohammed hired a bunch of thugs to help him raid the Meccan caravans, he found that the women were becoming more and more rebellious and outspoken, and his friend Omar decided something had to be done about it. So he encouraged Mohammed to receive a revelation from Allah to bring women under control. And at this point, Mohammed had two revelations. It was revealed to him that women should be beaten into submission, and then it was revealed to him that they should be isolated by putting them under veils. And these are two of the most important factors that create the Stockholm Syndrome, isolation from perspectives other than those of the captor, death threats, a devaluation, the abusers become the good guys, and those who are trying to fight the abusers are the bad guys. It all of these things come into play with just those two things that Mohammed brought in through the revelation of Allah. And the result is that the woman has a complete a mind flip, if you will. She starts to perceive reality through the eyes of the perpetrator, and the outside world becomes the enemy. And that's why you have so many Muslim women writing into you and with anger, because they've been completely dissociated from reality through this roller coaster ride of Islam.
And in so doing, they're so isolated from reality that evidence and reason have no value in confronting their lack of judgment, their inappropriate perspective.
No, the Stockholm Syndrome can persist for years and years. And we saw this in Sweden. Like I mentioned before, two of the women who were captives actually became engaged to two of the men who, while they were in jail. It's truly counterintuitive what happens in the Stockholm Syndrome, but Islam practices the Stockholm Syndrome on an industrial scale, with about half of a billion Muslim women are kept in this dissociative state for life, with no hope of escaping without being murdered. Many of the women who eventually become go into despair because of the Islam's captivity. The only way out is through suicide, and there are tens of thousands of Muslim women who do commit suicide every year because they just can't take it anymore. And there's no possible escape without leaving their entire family, their children. So they in this state of despair of being a lifelong captive, they choose suicide. Has been less painful.
Now, Robert, you've done a marvelous job of explaining through the Stockholm Syndrome how disassociation and how combinations of severe beatings and then moments of mercy where they're allowed to use the restroom, they're allowed to eat, and they might receive some sexual pleasure from their master, has caused women to acquiesce to their oppression and to actually be proponents of the oppression. But that's only half the equation. For the most part, it is Muslim men who are terrorists. For the most part, it is Muslim men who are so savagely oppressing the world. It is mostly Muslim men, for example, that have murdered 60 or 70,000 people in Syria. So what is it about the Stockholm Syndrome that attracts men to this religion and motivates them to advance the religion?
Well, it's called narcissistic personality disorder. And it's a state where the male ego creates a false persona, a heroic persona, a larger than life persona. This is what Muslim men see in Mohammed. Mohammed is the perfect example for Muslim men. So imitating every behavior of Mohammed is good. Imitating his rapes is good. Imitating his genocide is good. Imitating his theft, his robberies, is good. All of the things which we consider crimes in the modern world are good if it's done in the name of Allah and if it's done to imitate Muhammad. Most people have a little bit of narcissism in them, which is to say we want to eat, we want to have a job, we want to have a happy family. But when it goes to an extreme level, it becomes narcissistic personality disorder, where the person loses touch with reality, and beyond that, there's true psychopathy, where a person loses completely their consciousness. Now we see this continuum of behaviors in the Muslim community, where you have Muslims who will drink alcohol, they'll have bacon sandwiches, and then you have others who become more and more intense until they become jihadists, and they're completely sociopathic at that point.
Yeah, Robert, one of the things that strikes me is that I've shared with you that the majority of my letters written to Prophet of Doom were by Muslim women who've been so savagely oppressed by the religion, advocating on behalf of the religion. And the other group, the other letters are from Islamic men. Now, there's always this exact same scenario among the Islamic men. They're astonishingly egotistical, narcissistic to an extreme level, so extraordinarily proud of themselves and their abilities and their religions, and of course, they're idiots. I mean, they literally, from a point of view of reading someone's writing and determining whether or not they possess the facts, whether or not they can process the facts rationally, whether they can communicate intelligently, they're absolute nincompoops. And yet they claim the superiority of intellect. They come from countries that are incredibly impoverished, the most hellish places on earth to live, where there is no inventiveness, there's no opportunity, there's no economy, there's no freedom, there's no access to education. And yet they speak as if their religion was the greatest thing that's ever been given humankind. And yet every place that their religion dominates is the most hellish place on earth. It's the poster child for what you're explaining.
Well, what you're observing is called Gira. It's a word, that means I'm just trying to get it explained in the right way. It's an Arabic expression that means protective jealousy. And they're being protective of Mohammed and of Islam. It's really basically a male dominance display, just as we see.
Yes, it is, clearly.
Primates who make faces. They scream.
Lions roar. Gorillas pound their chest.
And they exactly. Then they charge. They rip off parts of your argument and throw them at you.
Right.
And then they use curse words. It's
of course.
Just a dominance display. It has nothing to do with rationality,
of course.
It doesn't take any effort of intellect. It's just a very primitive, animalistic kind of response. And Mohammed said that he had the most gira of anyone, and so. Who are you supposed to imitate? You imitate Mohammed. You do these dominance displays whenever you're around infidels. And this is part of what creates the Stockholm syndrome.
Extraordinary arrogance without justification. Everything says don't be arrogant because everything you've touched has turned to mud. I mean, everything has crumbled beneath your feet. You're living in the worst of all possible circumstances. You ought to be the opposite of arrogant, and yet they're arrogant. We're going to return to with Kenneth Roberts after the commercial break. Wonderful discussion. I'm delighted, Kenneth, that you're a part of the program today. We'll be back in a moment. Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have our final segment here with Kenneth Roberts. I hope that we are able to have Kenneth back in a future program. There's lots more to talk about. But I would like to conclude our conversation, at least today, on an aspect of Gira that you have presented. If you dumb men down to the point that they don't soar with intellect, but instead are completely fixated on their animalistic nature, then as an animal, man covets sex. And in this regard, with the Stockholm syndrome and giving men a total authority over women who have no rights, men the right to beat their women, and even a paradise where the constant conquest of virgins is the reward, you have really created a monstrous motivation for the animals that become Muslims, have you not?
Absolutely. It appeals to the alpha male instinct in every male. And it especially appeals to young men who are, let's say, under the age of 30, who are experiencing one of the highest discharges of hormone in their whole life. These are actually the people who are the jihadists. It's been studied that the age group is usually men under 30. After the age of 30, they burn out and they're disinterested in jihad at that point for the most part. Or the ones who continue in jihad are managing the jihad, but they're not doing it themselves.
Correct. You know, it reminds me of the imam that will tell the young boy, you know, you're so ugly, you have nothing going for you, you're never going to ever be able to have sex with a woman because they're just going to find you completely useless. But if you commit this suicide bombing and kill a bunch of people, then you're going to go directly to Allah, and Allah's going to give you the 72 virgins. It's your only chance of sex. And that's how these young boys are motivated to become suicide bombers.
Well, absolutely, and they boast about, oh, now this is my wedding day. When they're going to blow themselves up, they say, this is my wedding day. I'm going to be married in paradise. And you're absolutely correct.
It's a hideous situation, and to a large degree, the exact thing that you explain here is true. The one that's motivated to sacrifice his or her life as a suicide bomber, which is what happened on 9/11, those were suicide bombings by fundamentalist Muslims, they are the young men that think that this is my best way to have a unlimited supply of sexual conquests, and yet the people that motivated them are much older imams who have deceived them by telling them that this is the reward for acting so badly.
Well, I agree with you. I think most of the mullahs in the world, there are about a million of them, most of the mullahs know everything that we're saying right now. They absolutely know all the problems in Islam.
Right.
They've read all the books
right.
that we've read. And
yes.
they continue doing it because it's a job for them.
Right. And it gives them power and authority in their community.
And you have probably noticed that very few mullahs write into you to dispute
correct.
Your facts in Prophet of Doom. Because
correct.
They know that you're correct.
Correct.
There's no disputing any of your facts because all of your facts are accurate. And they know it.
In fact, you've read Prophet of Doom, haven't you, Kenneth?
That was one of the first books that I read after 9/11. I started reading that a few years later, and it was very influential. It's a tremendous resource book, and I recommend it heartily to everyone who's listening.
And when, of course, we're not doing this for any financial gain. Prophet of Doom is
no.
free. Kenneth's articles, which unlock many of the mysteries related to the motivation of Islam, are also free. We have a single motivation. We want people to know about this religion so that they are in a position not only to protect those they love from it, and what you're saying gives people the insight to expose it and condemn it based on moral grounds, but also we ought to care that 1.5 billion people are victims of this religion.
I totally agree. It's very similar to the anti-slavery movement in the United States during the 1840s to the 1860s. There's no Abraham Lincoln to free the slaves of Islam. But we are the abolitionist movement, and some of us are a Harriet Beecher Stowe writing books, and some of us are writing articles, and some of us are just talking to our neighbors. But we're all part of this abolitionist movement to free the slaves of Islam.
Thank you for being part of our program today. Look forward to having you back.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that...